What's up, everyone, and welcome back to Hot Take, where I, along with my co-host Nat and Lawrence, give you our hottest takes on all things NBA. Two big things real quick. First of all, welcome back, Lawrence. He's been MIA for a little bit, but he's back. He's here. He's here repping the Suns jersey.
Yes. Back, let Lawrence. The record show if I had this for a little bit. Did not just hop on the bandwagon.
And somebody who can prove that, somebody who can verify that information, is Chris Milholland. What's up, Chris? How you doing, man?
Doing good. How about you guys? And yes, Lawrence has had that jersey since high school, so he is not no newie to the bandwagon. He's had that for a while.
There we go. Verified. Verified. Chris, man, it's been a minute, but you know, we the last time you were on the show, we were like saying, you know, we definitely have to have you back. Unfortunately, like, things got a little bit lost here and there, but we're glad to have you back. I just want to kind of put it out there. I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything like that. I kind of did.
Here we go. I know where you're going. Just say it.
I kind of did have the Nets not making it to the NBA Finals. You know, I gave myself a little pat on the back there. But I will say this. I fully admit it. They were half an inch away from being in the NBA Finals. 100%.
Yeah, they were. You know, he does wear an extra size shoe, and you know that came to bite him in the butt. In the end.
Chris,
yeah.
I was there for Game 7, by the way.
You were?
I didn't know. Yeah, that was crazy. Okay. Were you there or no?
I was there for that game.
Oh man, I should have met up with you.
I was there for that game. Yeah, so that was my last game.
Last game of the year. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the last one.
So, Chris, let's ask you, because we got Nat's side of the story, right? We know, like, you know, Nat got an awesome experience there, but you, you know, being a writer for the Nets, like, what was it like being in the arena, how close that game was, and the back and forth between Bucks, Nets? What was that like for you?
Well, I'd say, like, the whole playoff run was pretty cool, right? Because, like, in the beginning, obviously, you know, the Knicks, they had the first round series against Atlanta, but once they got eliminated, that's kind of the hub of basketball in New York, right? So you have all the celebrities rolling in, sitting in front row, from Travis Scott, Jay-Z, Michael Strahan, just actors, celebrities all over the place sitting front row. You know, Barclays Center is one of those arenas that are fairly new, so it attracts a lot of celebrities, a lot of public transportation nearby. And, you know, throughout the whole playoffs, you know, in the regular season, they had pandemic sellouts, so it would be a certain amount. I think it was like 7,000-8,000 people. And then the latest one, I think Game 7 was nearing 15. Don't quote me on that. I'm pretty sure 15,000 people. But, you know, it's a high-intensity game. You know, with those home crowds, as all you guys know, and especially in a Game 7, a lot of teams like to have their fans there early to set the tone and grab some momentum right off the tip. So a lot of the fans poured in a little later, but not too bad. You know, they packed their seats by game time, but they weren't there. Pre-game warm-ups, usually there's probably about 35% of people there. You know, when the players come out and start shooting around, like Harden, KD, or Kyrie, all those guys. But obviously, two of them were injured at that time. But, you know, it was high intensity there. You know, you have all these guys, and obviously Milwaukee, they had Budenholzer's job was on the line and his point. So, obviously, true. You know, if they made that out, he would probably not be where he is today probably not sitting in the Bucks chair. Nets case, you know, you had Kevin Durant there. And, you know, it was a really epic game because, you know, you had the end of regulation when KD tied it with the two. And then at that point, sent it to the overtime. Then we all know what happened in the overtime. It was a footstep, literally a toe away, hit the – 3-point line from the right wing, and that tied it up. And then, you know, just after that the overtime happened. KD airballed the three, heavily contested three. You can point many questions to that. Fatigue, he played all the minutes. You know, it's hard for a lot of players to play all those minutes, especially overtime against a competitive team like Milwaukee, who's known for their physicality and a lot of just tight defense. And, you know, the Nets like to switch, so that takes a lot on your physicality and just your overall conditioning, especially when you had an overtime period. But overall, you know, that was easily the most electric game Barclays that I've been to. And since they moved there, it's
same.
But I would hope they knew that.
I actually have a couple questions for you because, like, obviously you're there for work, but I mean, because I don't personally know how it is, you know, people being in the business and whatnot, but were you going crazy, you know, like along with the fans? Like, what was that like?
Like, you know, it's hard to put it. Like, it's hard. I guess it would be maybe a little hard for you guys to understand. But after a while, when you have this as a job, you lose that fandom, right? It's work.
Okay.
You know, that's how you do it. So yeah, you know, like any writer, you know, we all get into sports for a reason, right? And that's because we grew up watching these sports, right? Like me, for example, Lawrence knows. I went to a lot of New Jersey Nets games when in the Izod Center on 17, 30-minute drive. Relocated to Brooklyn. Went to a lot of games there. 2013, the miserable seasons, all that type of stuff. And, yeah, and then, you know, just all those type of things. And then, you know, when you go to cover these games and everything like that, you know, you lose that fandom because, like, at the same time, when you talk to these players every single day on the Zoom calls and Coach Nash, you know, all these, obviously the Nets have a lot of personalities. You look at from the top to bottom, Steve Nash, Amari Stoudemire, KD, Harden, Kyrie, Blake, DeAndre Jordan, you know, and once you get to know these guys and, like, talk to them every single day on Zooms, like, it just becomes normal, you know? So, like, when you sit the arenas, for example, like, obviously I have a pretty cool job. I get to go to games. I don't have to pay for it or anything. I just sit there and do my jobs and stuff. But at the same time, you just lose that fandom, you know? So, you know, at the end of the day, it's work. Obviously, it's cool seeing iconic moments, you know, especially with KD, that electric game he had, I forgot how many points it was a while ago. It was 49 or something like that.
I think it was 49, yeah.
It was 49. Like, that was electric. He's arguably the greatest performer. Career,
right?
Obviously, Blake was dunking in that game as well. So you see a lot of these electric moments. But like I said before, you lose that fandom because you have work to do. You know, because it's like to give you guys a perspective of like what my job entails is you got to get that game recap in 5 minutes after the final buzzer, and in between that time, you have to have everything written out. And you guys have all probably read game recaps, right? So you guys know that if one play erase all that writing and you just have to go off it, include final stats, you wait for the box scores, you wait for the PR to send out the box scores, or you can check it off ESPN.
Yeah.
And when you submit that all in, you got to go to the Zooms, ask the coach questions, all that stuff. And then say the game, for example, ends at 11:30, you're not out of there until 1:30 in the morning because you're transcribing, you're adding articles, you write up the feature story for the AM based on what they say, if it's an outside story opinion or a big game. So you have all these types of work to it and stuff like that. So at the end of the day, you know, with sports journalists and stuff, you see it commonly in the field. Hopefully I'm not ranting about it, but sports journalists, you see it in the field. It's one of those things that a lot of fans get into it, but it shows how can I kind of word this? Like if you still have that fan mindset, you're not going to make it far in this field. Because players can sniff that out. Agents can sniff that out. All these people can just sniff it out. Right. So you got to just be biased. I report biasly. My work kind of shows that throughout my years and stuff like that. And yeah, just kind of just wrap it all up in a bow and answer that question. You know, you just lose that fandom. You just view it as work. It's just a regular job.
Who was the first person you interviewed after the loss?
That was Steve. That was Coach. So they always lead off with Steve after the game. And what they do with Zooms is typically they always have the players based on stat lines and performances. So KD, high scorer, he'll come next, or, you know, just your basic high scores. You know, like, think about it this way. If you were to not watch the game, but you saw, or you were to watch the game, you want to read about it, what players would you want to hear speak about it? The top scorers or the top playmakers. So that's who PR provides, right? So that was the one. Those Zooms were very, I guess you could say, depressing for that team, you know, because you see Steve, you see he's emotional about it. A lot of players were emotional about it, too, because that's the end of their season. You know, a lot of these players, you look from Blake Griffin, obviously not LaMarcus Aldridge, but you see all these players work so hard for that one goal. And obviously it's the media narrative, as you guys, like you talked about it, but all a little off air, is that, hey, the Nets were – supposed to make it all the way, right? Win the first lose the championship. Blake gets a ring. KD finally gets his ring. Kyrie and James make it get his ring. All that stuff gets in their heads, and when it gets all shut down and like it hits them in reality, like, you know, that's going to be a little depressing. So they were all talking about it at the same time too. You know, with guys like Blake, you ask about their futures because you don't know when you're going to talk to them again, unless you do some independent, you reach out to his agent, whatever, you talk like that. They ask, hey, do you regret your decision coming here? Do you, you know, you ask simple questions. So you put out an AM story or you have stories for the next couple of days that you can write up or whatever the case is. So, yeah, that's what the Zooms are like, to give you guys some insight on it.
So, I mean, I think we can all agree, like, this is KD's first full healthy season. Not healthy, but because he was out a few games. But since the Achilles injury, since him coming to Brooklyn – you know, I think we can all agree, especially in the playoffs, like, he showed out. Like, he he went off. So we have to give props where props is due. Like, what I can only imagine how scary this team will be next year. I know, like, there's, like, some players that are, like, up in the air, for example, like you mentioned, like, Blake Griffin, things like that. But I think a lot of things or a lot of players that people were sleeping on, myself included, like a Bruce Brown or, you know, Claxton, guys like that, who they, over the course of the season, started to really step up. I feel like Joe Harris wasn't really in his element. I think that's something that he's going to come back from, learn from, take in the whole nine yards. Where do you predict the Nets to be next season? Is it going to be the number one spot, number two? Like, realistically, where do you think they'll be?
Well, you know, it's always a lingering question, right? Because, like, I'm a big fan of having the NBA season start on MLK Day, because the thing is that it was such a heavily condensed season, 72 games. Then you go straight into playoffs, limited offseason where a lot of guys are on the bubble. Nets, for example, they got out in the first round or whatever the case is, but still, you know, that offseason wears off. That's why we saw so many injuries this year, a lot of especially soft tissue injuries. That's mostly because, hey, they haven't had that time to rest. So, you know, it's every team's future is going to be dictated on health, and that's as simple as you could sum it up with this Nets team, right? Because we saw what health did to them in the playoffs, right, with Harden, Irving. We saw what happened. If they had all three healthy, I think it's a foregone conclusion that, hey, if they got past Milwaukee, they would probably win it. So – and, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to a lot of offseason moves, because you got to look at veterans coming off, especially veterans, you know, signed. The Nets have an MMLE that's $5.8 million, and then they have the vets men that's $3.4 million. So they have two spots, and at the same time, they're very cap space restricted. So it all depends on how far Joe Tsai, which is the owner, wants to dive into that cap space, because or the luxury tax, because, hey, he can bring who he wants on, but they got to pay it. So are guys like Jeff Green going to go for a fourth straight year on a vet's min when he had a career year, shooting 40% from the corners, durability, played 68 games, second among Nets? Is he going to want to take another pay cut to go for a championship ring? Blake, obviously, is getting paid from Detroit still, so money's not really an issue for him. He's getting paid over $20 million still next year from that's paid in by Detroit. So it's like I wouldn't be surprised if he just signs for the vet min considering that amount. And you guys look at other guys like Bruce Brown. You know, he's even though he's a restricted free agent, like I said before, the Nets are so luxury cap hit, and their cap space is they're so limited on money. I guess you could say to dumb it down a little bit, that if he gets an offer over $8 million, are they just going to let him walk? Or are they going to match him? And then at the same other days, you guys know Team USA, you know, guys talk. You know, Kevin Love's been in a lot of rumors, but he didn't show out in Team USA. He withdrew after 10 days. He's still battling that lingering calf injury that took him out 27 games in the regular season or whatever it was. So you have all these little additions. PJ Tucker's also been rumored, which I would not be surprised about if he did come. Honestly, I think that makes the most sense. And, you know, it depends on how this roster shapes out and everything, but it's a foregone conclusion, I think, that these guys would easily end up in the top three again in the Eastern Conference. You have three of the top 15 players, if not 10 players in the world. So, like I said before in the very beginning, if health's on their side, they're going to end up in top three.
I have a question. Do you have any insight on Spencer Dinwiddie?
And I was just about to ask.
Potential? Oh, really? Okay.
Just about to ask, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so Chris, you know, I'm sorry, blue check Chris. I have to add that as well on Twitter, right?
There are ways that they can go about it. Like I said, with the luxury tax, right? Spencer Dinwiddie, we talked with Howard Beck, who you guys probably know of his work. And he did an interview with him. He said, hey, if it's a five-year, $25 million deal, I don't mind re-signing with the Nets. Obviously, that's a lot for a backup point guard to leave his second unit. Again, that would be coming out of luxury tax, and Joe Tsai would be paying that, a good amount of it, at least a portion of it. Another opportunity that they could do is do the D'Angelo Russell method, which makes more sense. They could sign and trade him. Sign him to the max, give him a five-year, 145, or depends on a lot of teams and their cap situations and stuff, but sign him ultimately close to a max contract, then it's time to trade him somewhere. You could see the Lakers going with Alex Caruso, sending him back, whatever the case is, Alex Caruso, KCP.
I'm a fan
of sending him back to Denver, where he played college ball, get Will Barton return. I think that would help out both cap situations, because Denver doesn't have money to spend. You pair him with Jamal Murray and Jokic, I think that's a very lethal team. And then there's other stuff. You heard the Clippers, obviously, they do need a starting point guard. You know, Patrick Beverley, he's good on defense. He brings that intensity. But we saw in the postseason that they really do need scoring, you know, as much as especially with Kawhi Leonard and his player option, obviously what he's going to do with his player option. I would be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if he opts out, but at the same time, he did tear his ACL. He's going to be recovering for a long time. So you don't know what's going to happen there. So I wouldn't be surprised if they just say, you know what, bring him to the Clippers, make Kawhi happy, give him an offensive guard. Plus at the end of the day too, the offensive guard market is very low this year. You look at the free agents, available free agents, and sign trades, player options, it's very, very low. So that ultimately makes contracts more feasible for players to sign for. So Spencer Dinwiddie could be offered a lucrative contract maybe above his market value, but he'll still get it because of the competition that's around at that position. So ultimately, do I think he's going to be back with the Nets next year? I wouldn't bet on it. I would say he's most likely going to leave. But like I said before, it's in the Nets' hands, and Sean Marks is a smart guy. So, you know, he's gonna do what he could to make Spencer happy. But I think ultimately, just opinion-based, I think it's going to end up like a D'Angelo Russell situation where the sign. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Before we move on to the NBA Finals, I just want to throw this out there. I'm just curious. If you're the mm-hmm. Brooklyn Nets and you do the sign and trade option, you know, with Spencer Dinwiddie, is there anybody on Miami's roster that piques your interest?
You know, Miami.
Because I love Spencer Dinwiddie.
Well, we all know who Spencer Dinwiddie is. You know, he's a very underrated guard, but you know, he's two ACL tears, one in college, one now, a little injury prone. You know, with Miami, you know how Pat Riley works down there. He doesn't let anything out. You know, he's one of those guys that keep it close-knit, and then he'll break the news when it's like 10 seconds or the paper's already signed. So could the Nets go with a Duncan Robinson and add more shooting? Because, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. J.J. Redick's probably going to come on the buyout market, most likely.
True.
I wouldn't be surprised about that. He lives in Tribeca. You know, it comes in full circle. You saw what happened when he got traded to Dallas. He wanted to go to a contender. Now he has his futures in his own hands. Makes sense. With Miami, I wouldn't like it, you know.
Chris, don't give him hope, Chris. Don't give him any hope.
If you got me thinking, there's not much hope here.
Yes.
Honestly, it's Duncan. Like, I know you guys love your little Tyler Hero down there. I don't know, but you guys did mess up not trading for James Harden. I'll tell you that. But
True.
I don't know. Like, true. You got to see how it pans out. I'd say if there is one guy, maybe don't. But that's it.
All right. Fair enough. Let's move on to because we're recording this prior to Game 5 of the NBA Finals. We're doing this is part one. We're going to do part two after after Game 5. The last couple games, Nat and I have covered. We covered Game 1, Game 2. We attempted to cover Game 3 and 4, but I had tech issues on my end. So here we are with the addition of Chris and Lawrence. Before we jump right into it, just real quick, Chris, who did you have winning the NBA Finals between these two?
I had the Suns in six because I think the Suns – before the whole series started, because I didn't know how healthy Giannis was going to be, right? Because when you play with a hyperextended knee and when you have that type of responsibility and load on you, not just on the offensive end but on the defensive end, I didn't know how the wear and tear was going to be. Obviously, they lost Dante DiVincenzo, which is literally the best wing defender too. So you know how that's operate. It's a lot of movement that we have to go through the rings and other out there, especially with pacing and spacing. So that's what I had. I had Suns and six to begin with. I think. Well, do I go with Suns and six? I'm sticking with the Suns and six. Because like that's what I had. That's what I had. I had Suns and six to begin with. Yeah. And then for tonight, what do you want? Like a little preview of tonight? What I think is going to happen?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do your prediction, and then we'll go to Lawrence.
Well, I think the game is going to be dictated on Chris Middleton, right? Because he hasn't played well on the road, and obviously the saying goes, the series doesn't start until someone wins on the road.
Right.
And right. Middleton, we saw that. First off, if he scores over 20 points, I think the stat is what? I think the Bucks are like 6-0 or 7-0 in the playoffs when he does that. So you see how valuable he is when he's scoring a ball at the effective clip. And again, like I said, the reason I bring this up is because Chris Middleton has struggled on the road throughout the playoffs, aside from Game 7 against the Nets, with scoring the ball and having that load. And especially with the Bucks, they rely so much on their shot making. Because I like what they're doing with Giannis. I don't understand why. Like, the Bucks are the most frustrating team to watch because, like, they don't make adjustments. And at the same time, they have Giannis shooting threes. Like, I don't, like, why would you have him shooting threes? Like, I get it. Like, that, like, if it's a dare shot, sure, you want to test it out, go ahead and do it. But, like, you shouldn't, like, I don't understand why he's shooting threes. So, like, for tonight, I think it's going to be dictated solely on Middleton. The other side, Chris Paul, obviously, you saw what he's done with the turnovers. He hasn't been, it looks like the lights are getting to him a little bit. And obviously, you know, Devin Booker, he's had a couple of rough games as well. Obviously, not last game, but the game before that. And then you look at guys like Cam Johnson, just Jay Crowder. You know, you just look down the roster and how effective these guys are going to be with scoring the ball. You see Jay Crowder, he's electric from the corners with shooting the ball. Cam Johnson's more of kind of that 3-and-D guy that really serves some value. But, you know, at the end of the day, just sum it up, it's going to be how well can Chris Middleton perform on the under road lights, especially on the offensive end, and how well can Chris Paul actually facilitate and go get over that turnover hump. That's what it's going to be dictated about. Personally, I think the Suns are going to win tonight.
Lawrence, who did you have winning prior to this series starting?
Yeah, I also had the Suns, also in six. So
great minds think alike.
I had Suns in five, man.
I had Suns in six. I had Suns in six. Lawrence, let me ask you this. Like, from, you know, games three and four, is there something to you that just kind of stands out, something that you've noticed that is a key contributor to why the Bucks have won against the Suns in games three and four?
I think it's, I mean, Chris really pointed to it. The effectiveness of Chris Middleton. He's shown that he is the quote-unquote Batman of the Bucks, and that Giannis is the Robin, and it really is the turnovers of Chris Paul, right? This is, like, historically bad for Chris Paul, 15 turnovers in the past three games. Like, I don't know if this is him just, you know, choking. I hope not. You know, we don't think so. And this is point God himself. But I really think it's those two things that are really making the big difference in this series right now. And also, that was the home field advantage of, you know, Milwaukee Bucks. You see David Bakhtiari, even the Beers crowd. Like, they know how to do it up there in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. They do. They do. They know how to get it done. Nat, let me ask you, because you and I were talking about this on Thursday. We noticed how games three and four, you kind of saw it in game two. It really started in game two where you started to see, like, a transformation within Giannis and his tunnel vision of, I'm just going to take it to the rack every single time. I'm just going to pound it down low every single time, downhill, 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 and it's been extremely effective. Is there a player that the Suns have that you think, not necessarily stop him, but can potentially contain him?
Lawrence and Chris, I wish you were there for this conversation, but I don't know why, but PJ is vouching for Frank Kaminsky to get minutes.
Give me and Frank.
I was like, hell to the no. You do not play Frank Kaminsky.
It's not Wisconsin anymore. It's not Wisconsin anymore.
In any of the minutes here, I would rather play Cam Johnson 30 minutes or more than Frank Kaminsky for five. You know, it's just simple as that. But for tonight, I have the Bucks winning just because everyone here is picking the Suns. I need to be different here, you know. I think today is a Jrue Holiday game. He's been struggling for the past four games. Middleton, I think, is going to shrink as he usually does on and off almost every day. I mean, every other day that they play. And I think we'll have Giannis do his normal output and have Jrue Holiday step up and win on the road. And I think whoever wins tonight will win game six. So it'll be over in the six. I think it's the Bucks, man. We'll see.
Well, I think I'll add this, right? Because, like, the Frank Kaminsky point got me thinking, right? Because, like, this is the thing, right? I know why you got, like, the reason why Frank Kaminsky's, like, getting these debates is because DeAndre Ayton, I don't know what they're doing with him. Because, like, Chris Paul has not found DeAndre Ayton in mismatches. I don't know what they're doing, but that's the reason why they're so ineffective from the perimeter. DeAndre Ayton is literally their I guess, effective, their highest effective field goal percentage shooter, say, on the team, right? And when you don't utilize, when you have to put so much, especially in the Suns offense, when you have a center that's not afraid, not just a traditional center, but it's a center that could not shoot from three, but could really be effective in the mid-range, you have to utilize mismatches. because that just opens up spacing on the perimeter. They shot 29.4% or something like that the other night from three. So that was the whole reason to it. So like that's another key point is that they have to like that. That's where Chris Paul comes into play. They have to just really utilize DeAndre Ayton in mismatches here. And against a Bucks team that likes to play small, it's not that hard of a task.
So just to kind of clarify my point was throw Frank the Tank in there just to give some hard fouls to Giannis to get him second guessing a little bit here and there. You know, especially at the time, it was his free throw troubles. But we've seen over the last few games, props to Giannis, one game he went like 13 for 17, you know, something ridiculous, which is a huge, vast improvement from previous games. And I'm sure you guys noticed it too. At the end of game four, he was doing something that I hadn't seen him do before, which was he was getting ready to get fouled, and he would pass instead of shoot to avoid going to the free throw line, which is probably one of the most genius things because one is he doesn't have to shoot free throws. Secondly, they get to take it out and drop another play for another way to get, you know, 2-3 points, wherever the case is. And then he was doing that in closing minutes, which is one of the reasons why I thought they ended up winning game four because, I mean, it was like, what, like 9 minutes left in the game or like, I don't know, I think 11 minutes left in the game. Suns were up by 9, end up losing it. You know, I think it was just the little things down the line that kind of solidified the win for the Bucks. What kind of worries me for the Suns is you see in those close moments, like, you know, the Bucks being down 9 at the start of the fourth quarter, but there's something about them where, like, they're just going to keep hitting you in the mouth, and it's like the Suns don't know how to respond. And you guys mentioned earlier the whole Chris Paul situation. You know, there's a lot of speculation that I've been hearing that, you know, he's potentially injured, you know, he's the ligaments in his wrist and his hand, you know, all that stuff. And there's certain moves, like, my thinking is it's a 7-game series. It's a long series. Players such as Jrue Holiday and, you know, his caliber as a defensive player, he's going to pick up on little things. Even Pat Connaughton, I noticed it in game three where Chris Paul would get the ideal switch, and we've seen him in games one and two torch the big man, you know, with like his little in and outs and getting to the rim or going up for the elbow jump shot. What I noticed was he was trying to do those little in and outs, those little like hesitation moves on Pat Connaughton, and Pat didn't budge. It's like he knew exactly what Chris Paul was trying to do. And I think that's the advantage of being in a long, you know, series, doing your homework, studying film, the whole nine yards. So it's kind of like, yes, you know, potentially Chris is injured, but at the same time, you have to give credit where credit is due in, you know, the Milwaukee Bucks defense. So now it's kind of like, Chris, you're the point guard. You have to figure something out. You know, you have to find other ways to get other people involved. I know DeAndre Ayton's been shooting really well, but I feel like for this game, like they have to get him early touches, get him up there early. And of course, you know, stay out of foul trouble for everybody, basically, on the Suns team. I'm sure you got everybody knows about the egregious no calls of game four. You know, especially on.
Well, that was a makeup call at the end of the day. That was a makeup call.
Right.
That was easily a makeup call. Yeah. You saw the two possessions ago. It was a makeup call.
I don't know about you guys, but for me,
Well, let me get to your point, like about like the adjustments, right? Because like in any any playoff game series, teams know the other team's plays by game three. Because like it's repetitive, right? So that's why I brought the point earlier with Milwaukee being frustrated because they don't make those adjustments. They play off flow, they play off tempo and stuff. So like, that's why you saw in the beginning when Phoenix was really getting rolling early is because they know what they're running. And Milwaukee doesn't know how to respond in the first couple games. But, I thought I'd just sprinkle that in there.
No, absolutely. And, like, you see it, like, I don't know. I kind of talked about it after game two. It was one of my concerns was, especially with Chris Paul being a 36-year-old point guard, being in the league for 16 years, this being his first NBA Finals appearance, like, I don't know if he's in the long haul physically, conditionally for it, like, in the sense that those in games one and two, those, you know, switching to get the big man on you and doing the little in and out, shooting from the elbow, shooting from the 3-point, like that was all fine and dandy. But are you able to maintain that, you know, throughout the course of a 7-game series, Or is it going to be the type of thing where like your legs give out, especially if you're playing like heavy minutes? I mean, we saw what you know happened to Kevin Durant where in game seven where he did airball the ball. And the thing is that if he had, he played extremely heavy minutes. So my thinking is that what's happening to Chris Paul because he is older, you know, not having the legs under him really to get those kind of shots off because a lot of them, you know, either falling short or they're just off the mark. I think there's a lot of factors, and I think that's one of the reasons why I mentioned this when we were trying to record Thursday night. I feel like any contender in the NBA Finals needs to have at least two efficient and consistent scores. So for Milwaukee, you have Chris Middleton, you have Giannis. For the Suns, ideally, it would be Chris Paul and Devin Booker. Last game, we saw Devin Booker going off, but there was nobody else really going off, with the exception of, to me, in my opinion, Cam Johnson. And I was kind of like, just keep feeding Cam Johnson. Like, he has that look in his eye where, like, he has no fear whatsoever. He's going to take that open three. He's going to go blow by his defender. He's one of the prettiest forms I've seen among, like, young NBA players. Like, his jumper is really pretty. So I'm just kind of on the Cam Johnson bandwagon, like just getting more touches, like let him go off, let him eat. For you, Chris, like in your opinion, what do the Suns need to do tonight in order to solidify a game five victory?
Well, aside from the finding DeAndre Ayton on the mismatches and capitalizing off that, you know, it's just they got to know how to take damage and respond, because at the end of the day, you know, it's like with the Suns, right? Obviously, it starts with Chris Paul. He's the floor general. So much responsibility on that aspect. You have to just really lower the turnovers, lower the ball security. At the same time, we've seen it with Devin Booker when he has these big games. Like, not a lot of his supporting cast, like, really compliment him that well, right? We've seen it with the 70-point game. We saw it this time around with the other ones during the season when he had a couple 40-pieces and 50-pieces. We saw that as well. So it's a recurring theme there. But, you know, it's – I think with the Suns, it just all comes down to extra effort plays. You know, that's going to be the big kind of takeaway here, because that they have to have the extra plays. Because, like, number one, Milwaukee has dominated them on the boards, and that just comes back again with DeAndre Ayton, right? Because, like, what they do with DeAndre Ayton is he's good in drop, but he can't play when they take him out of the paint and then they gang rebound. Milwaukee likes to gang rebound. They like to do all these other little aspects. So I'd say just touching up on the minor details and extra effort plays aside from like individual contributions outside.
Lawrence, what about you, man? Like, what do you think the Suns need to do in order to solidify a game five victory?
I just think we need consistency, right? They mentioned that Devin Booker, like that game three, 10 points, like out of nowhere, right? Like, the entire playoffs, he's been their killer. He's been playing like Kobe. A lot of people noted to that. So we need all-star Devin Booker. We need that offensive output from him. DeAndre Ayton's got to be physical. He's got to be able to match up and hold his own against Giannis. Without that, you know, Giannis is just going to continue to take over. He's going to continue to have these 40, 10, and 10 games over and over and over again. Like, and if that's going to happen, the Bucks are going to continue to have success. And then I'll note to it again, Chris Paul's got to get those turnovers. He's got to protect the ball and be able to facilitate well and lead, be the floor general for the team.
So on the flip side,
the Bucks are going to be missing their defensive assistant right here. So he's out because of the finesse on the health and safety protocols. He also got taken out. Yeah, give me Suns. That's it.
So Nat, before you go, Nat, let me ask you, because you're the only one who said the Bucks are going to win tonight. What do the Bucks need to do in order to win game five?
Just make shots at this point. Like, they kind of just live and die by how efficient they are on the offensive end. But going back to the Suns though, cause this is important. I think, Chris was, you know, on point with that. Like with Ayton, like the pick and roll works with Ayton, like pick and roll with Booker, Ayton, or CP3 and Ayton. It works every single time. Almost. It's kind of unstoppable to this point. And if they keep running that tonight, cause they didn't do it that much in game four, do that tonight, I think they're going to get that win. But for the Bucks side, on the Bucks side, definitely just efficiency from Giannis, from Drew, and from Chris. Pat Connaughton is there for that clutch shot. We've seen him prove it in game one and in game four a few days ago. Brook Lopez is going to be good too. Tucker always going to give you that defensive. Don't do that. That defensive, presence that they need. So I think that it's literally anyone's game. This is a pivotal game five, and it's anyone's game. It's going to be crazy who wins tonight. That we're going to cover it afterwards, but I have the Bucks, of course.
All right. So, I mean, you know, I feel like we all kind of did our part in recapping games three and four, getting ready for game five tonight. Just a quick recap, Chris, Lawrence, myself, we have the Suns winning tonight. Nat, he wants to be, you know, different, stand out. He has the Bucks winning tonight. So what we'll do is we're going to go ahead, we'll get settled in, do our own thing, get ready for game five. And then we'll do part two of this podcast. Everybody's going to come back. We're going to discuss, recap game five. And then we're also going to talk Team USA. So stay tuned for that. So catch us for part two of episode 46.
This has been a Fuse Podcast original produced by yours truly, Nat, with music by Johnny C.